I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm speaking today with Michael Cavallaro. Michael's the author of a new novel called Cybernetica, which is about the future of computers and the brain, and inspired by a lot of current and ongoing events in the neural computer interface. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Michael, what first inspired this novel? I understand that you were reading a report about the 100 top economic entities in the world.
Yeah, that was actually one of the things that sort of caught my attention. But I think what really sort of drove the main plot of the story was the research that I did on subliminal learning. And I think that a lot of my own experiences in terms of feeling like, you know, an individual caught in a society that is essentially, you know, driven by large organizations that sort of tell them what to do and what to buy, what to wear and how to think. So, as far as the corporations, you know, becoming as powerful as governments, that was something that that only added to it, and I think you know, it provided a lot of inspiration for, you know, what eventually became the book.
Your novel kind of touches on the theme of the emergence of a friendly kind of fascism as we begin to cede more of our autonomy to various kinds of corporate data aggregation and corporate influence.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose it does seem friendly fascism. One of the things that inspired the book as well was the Unabomber Manifesto written by Ted Kaczynski, which I had read about 4 years ago, and I thought it was somewhat disturbing insofar as he elucidates a lot of problems in society in relation to technology that I think that you know, we have to deal with and that we haven't dealt with. And one of the things that, you know, he says about technology, or in terms of its relation to society, is that every technology really starts off as beneficial, and then you know, because of external forces, it later goes on to become an oppressive force.
So one of the things that you're very concerned about is the Patriot Act and the kinds of government intrusion into privacy. I guess the recent revelations about the NSA must give you much pause in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, you know, the history of electronic surveillance, you know, computers, the Internet essentially started in the 1960s. And the government was interested in, it really spawned as a result of the fear of nuclear attack, and that's essentially what led to the creation of, you know, interstate highways, because they wanted to find ways to drive people out of cities in the event of such an attack. And one of the lateral effects was the creation of the Internet, and it was essentially a military defense system which was created. And that actually led to, or what they, you know, intended it to be, was a massive decentralization information system. And as it became very, very commercialized, they wanted to then, you know, centralize it back, and that's really where we're at right now. But, you know, when you talk about legislation, you know, in 1986, Congress passed a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which essentially makes it a crime to break into computer systems, which is what they were having a lot of trouble with as the Internet became a larger, more complex system. But in typical congressional fashion, the law didn't apply to those individuals that were largely responsible for computer cybercrimes, which were juveniles.
So what do you think we should be doing about hacking? I mean, don't you think that hacking is a serious problem and requires these kinds of government and private sector forms of security?
Probably. But at the same time, we need what they essentially call white and black hat hackers. I mean, well, the white hat hackers are the sort of friendly hackers, the ones who break into systems to figure out how to better improve the systems. And then, of course, there's the black hat hackers, which are the ones that we have to worry more about. They could be the terrorists, the people who are as Ted Kaczynski described, become disgruntled by society as a result of the external forces that are forced upon the technological society.
I'm speaking with Michael Cavallaro. He's the author of the novel Cybernetica. Michael, in one of the central features of your future that you describe in Cybernetica is the notion of sublimation. You just describe what sublimation technology is.
Yeah. Psychological research. I had read a long time ago that our brain is divided into two worlds: the conscious and the unconscious. And the way our brain works, it's essentially a information storage system. And the way the conscious works is that as information is absorbed into the unconscious, it runs out of room, and the unconscious has far greater storage capacity. So what the brain essentially does is that it severs intraneuronal connections, or it pushes old information, old data, from the conscious level into the subconscious level. So what sublimation essentially was a reversion of that process, where wireless encryption technology, encoded messages, would be wirelessly transmitted into the subconscious of a neural implant, and then eventually, give rise in the conscious level to essentially elucidate a certain type of desired reaction. And it works on in different ways, because over time, as external forces begin to affect the system, such as people who are becoming disgruntled by people who are left out of this particular technology, the government essentially uses the technology to drive history in desired directions, and that's I think where we worry about government tending to levy too much influence on individual freedoms.
This kind of concrete manifestation of Noam Chomsky's idea of the manufacture of consent, the notion that there would be an actual technology which would manufacture consent.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, Noam Chomsky has a lot of concerns about technology simply because, he's essentially an activist who's concerned about human freedoms. So I can understand why that would be. But one of the interesting things about what I learned about subliminal advertising, or essentially even cybernetics, I mean, if you look at cybernetics, that's essentially the relationship between the controller and the controlled. And one of the theories within cybernetics is this idea of metasystem transition control. And so that sort of, in a sense, evades the idea of manufacturing consent, or at least manufacturers' consent by way of their own design. What essentially metasystem transition control does is that it takes the controller takes information and they send it out to the controlled or the subject, and based on the reaction or the feedback of the person being controlled or the subject being controlled, they then analyze the feedback and figure out how they want to drive information back toward the subject so as to create a more desired response.
One of the features of your future is this notion of blind sight, that some people have an incapacity to use this sublimation technology to benefit from it. And the folks with blind sight are seen both as security risks because they're not subject to the same kind of social control, as well as being a second class in society because they can't benefit from its actual economic, you get many benefits in your work life from being able to use this technology. So do you think this is more of an inevitability of the kinds of neurotechnologies that we're developing today?
Well, I mean, most transhumanists believe that there are three types of scenarios when you talk about the future of technology. They believe that there's the hell scenario, which is sort of what Cybernetica is. Then there is the heaven scenario, which is the unlocking of our freedoms and the amplification of the human experience to prodigious levels that we almost can't even imagine. And then, of course, there's the prevail scenario, which is essentially a conflation of the two. I think it's probably going to be somewhere in the middle. I mean, I think that people who are overly technophobic tend to rule out some of the things that technology will essentially eliminate, some of the problems that technology will essentially eliminate. Of course, it'll open it to various forms oppression, but I think it's going to be somewhere in the middle.
So you're not trying to create a purely cautionary tale. You're trying to describe a future in a way that will hopefully bring about a better future than the one you're describing.
Well, I mean, there are two. If you look at the book, there are two types of technologies that emerge out of a series of wars between the government and corporations. The first type of technology is obviously mind control, brain-computer interface. The second technology is developed by corporations, which is essentially the amplification of the human being on a purely physical plane. And the ending of the story is sort of a hopeful one. It's not one that sort of leads us down a road where everything is pretty much hopeless. But I think it may be somewhere in between.
Another one of the themes in your novel is that there are people who are struggling against this new cybernetic future. There's a war going on. And can you describe the nature of collective? You say that the struggle of the individual against the collective is one of these themes, but there's also collective action happening on the part of people struggling against these dystopian aspects.
Well, so there's actually a war on two fronts. The government is fighting a war in the battle vectors of cyberspace, where a group of insurgents who become neurologically immune to the effects of sublimation, they become essentially outcasts, they attack the battle vectors of cyberspace so as to inspire a revolution within various areas of this particular city from which sublimation is born. The second battlefront is, well, there's actually two others. The second battlefront is between the government and corporation over this second technology called the Aptor chip, which the government somewhat covets. They want to sort of merge the two technologies together. Right now, as the story progresses, they have total control over the people that they control, but they want to create a sort of neo-human soldier that would be able to resist certain things within the battlefield and create a superior advantage so as to maintain the original technology. The third battlefront is the battlefront between the actual civilization that is not wired to sublimation at all and the civilization that is wired to sublimation. So there are three battlefronts that the world government is essentially trying to fight. And the book is about the people who become sort of trapped in the middle of that conflict.
But in those battles, at least in the first and the third, it's a battle against these networking technologies, these neural networking technologies. And one of the themes that I see at least many techno-utopians proposing is the notion that these technologies would empower people and empower forms of collective resistance, forms of democratization. Did you think about the possibility of folks within Cybernetica using these technologies in democratic ways to kind of fight back?
Well, I think, like I said, I've always believed that technology can be affected in either a good or bad way, depending on the external forces. And depending on what we are responsible in doing in democratic societies will probably lead to what is actually created. Some people, feel that, I know that Ray Kurzweil feels that we should just, invent no matter what, in spite of, democratic restraints. But I've always felt that, we just need to be responsible about that.
I'm speaking with Michael Cavallaro. He's the author of the novel Cybernetica, which is self-published. You want to tell us about your decision to go with the self-publishing route as opposed to trying to go through the corporates?
I've always felt that you can make more money on your own. And, I don't know if a lot of writers know this, but you only make 10% a profit when you're published with a major house. And there is a lot of things in between that it's not a very glorious position. Or most writers don't really make a lot of money doing it. And I just felt that I could actually empower myself a little bit more if I published the book on my own.
Your theme about corporations, obviously you have a personal interest in remaining free from corporate control, but it's also a theme in your novel of the growing power of corporations in our society. Do you consider yourself a person of the left, that you're proposing or foresee some kind of democratic accountability on the part of corporations, and that this novel is an attempt to wake people up to the power that corporations might evolve towards?
Well, you know, I'm not completely against corporations. I'm just, you know, like you, for social responsibility. I mean, you know, when you talk about, you know, research, I mean, you know, George Bush just signed a $3.7 billion research bill, for, you know, private companies to, research nanobot, technology. And nanobot technology, you know, will eventually, the idea, of course, is, to essentially eradicate cancer. Now, of course, that technology will eventually pave the way to other technologies, and other nanotech technologies that will eventually enhance what we are as humans, which paradoxically is something that this particular administration is fighting against. But I think it's more of a political struggle than it is really a moral one. They pretend that it's a moral one, but I think it's more of a political one.
The struggle against human enhancement on the part of the President's Council for Bioethics and people like that. That's the struggle we're talking about. Yeah, it is kind of schizophrenic on the part of the U.S. government.
Yeah,
the Bush. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I completely agree, because, I mean, one particular writer equated it to, you know, throwing a boulder in a river. You know, it doesn't really matter that the boulder's there, because the water is going to flow around the boulder and reach the same destination. And, you know, the only problem there is that other countries are going to be ahead of the curve. I mean, I don't know if you saw Superman, but, you know, there's a scene where Lex Luthor just, you know, talks about Prometheus and how Prometheus gave technology as a gift to the people. And he says that whoever controls technology controls the world. And, you know, I'm not saying this in a pointed way, but, you know, this administration particularly is, you know, interested in the drive for power. So I'm not sure how they, you know, resolve that that paradox in their thinking. But, I mean, it is essentially like water going around a boulder.
In my novel, my book, Citizen Cyborg, which is about the politics of biotechnology, I say just very briefly that one of the hopes I have is that we'll develop spam filters for our brain, that once we have neural technology, we'll become more aware of the ways that we're being manipulated and be able to set up firewalls to keep that kind of manipulation out. And people have commented that they thought that was a pretty ludicrous idea. But one of the technologies that I thought was an example of that is Steve Mann up in Toronto is a cyberneticist who has been wearing for about 25 years computers with displays. And he's rigged his computer display system up so that when he's looking at advertising or billboards, the billboards get erased and replaced with art or things that he's chosen. And I imagined that those kinds of technologies will become more sophisticated, more expert, and that we might have those kinds of filters in the future. Is that the kind of technology that might preserve our cognitive liberty against the kind of manipulation that you foresee coming down the pike as well?
Possibly. But I think that, you know, technology sort of, you know, is a sort of, you know, drives in two different directions. And there are industries that technology will affect that will affect other industries that are sort of like the opposite of that industry. For example, there's a new drug, I think, called Minofil or something like that. And
Modafinil?
Yeah. And what that essentially would do is it would allow the brain less sleep in order to be able to function. Now, that helps the caffeine industry, but what it does is adversely affects the sleep industry. So how are they going to counter that with their own technology? So, I mean, you know, it's a question of, you know, what conflicts does it create and, you know, what conflicts does it solve?
Michael, your novel Cybernetica is a very interesting exploration of our potential manipulation by corporate and government power in the future. I recommend it to folks who are interested in those kinds of themes, and you can find it online at cybernetica-novel.com.
Cybernetica-book.com.
Book.com. And I've been speaking with Michael Cavallaro. Thanks so much for joining us. Are you working on another novel?
Yes, I am. I'm working on a new one called Andaluvian Shadow, and it's actually related to Cybernetica. I briefly mentioned something in the book called The Synthetic Renaissance. Interestingly enough, I didn't mention this, but sublimation actually retards certain types of technologies from being created, obviously, among them being genetic enhancement for everyone and artificial intelligence. And in this particular new book, I sort of try to explore this event called the Synthetic Renaissance, which is sort of the beginning of the creation of AI, and how that's sort of being dealt with by people who don't want it to happen, and for people who want it advanced.
Another very rich theme. I look forward to reading that one as well. Thanks so much for joining us, Michael.
No problem. Thank you.
Now a message from the Campaign to Reform Marijuana Laws.
National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is Normal News. I'm Chris Goldstein. Our stories today include cannabinoids curb brain tumor growth, first ever patient trial shows, and Alaska judge rejects pot recriminalization measure. More information about these stories and membership in the Normal Foundation is available at NORML.org. First today, from Madrid, Spain, cannabinoids curb brain tumor growth, first ever patient trial shows. THC administration decreases recurrent glioblastoma multiforme, or GBM, tumor growth in humans, according to the findings of the first-ever clinical trial assessing cannabinoids' anti-tumor action. Investigators at Complutense University in Spain administered THC intratumorally in 9 patients diagnosed with recurrent GBM, an extremely rapid and lethal form of brain tumor. Patients in the study had previously failed standard therapy, surgery, and radiotherapy, and had clear evidence of tumor progression. THC treatment was associated with reduced tumor cell proliferation in 2 subjects, authors reported. Investigators did not determine whether THC positively impacted patient survival, though they did conclude that cannabinoid therapy does not facilitate cancer growth or decrease patients' life expectancy. Median survival of the cohort from the beginning of the cannabinoid administration was 24 weeks, and 2 patients survived for approximately 1 year. Survival for GBM patients following diagnosis is typically 6 to 12 months. Researchers speculated that newly diagnosed glioma patients may respond more favorably to cannabinoid-based therapies. Investigators also reported that THC demonstrated significant anti-proliferative activity on human GBM cells in culture. Quote, "The fair safety profile of THC, together with its possible anti-proliferative action on tumor cells reported here and in other studies, may set the basis for future trials aimed at evaluating the potential anti-tumoral activity of cannabinoids," close quote, investigators concluded. In 2005, investigators at the California Pacific Medical Center Research Institute in San Francisco reported that THC selectively decreases the proliferation of malignant cells and induces cell death in human GBM cell lines. Healthy cells in the study were unaffected by THC administration. Several preclinical studies indicate that cannabinoids and endocannabinoids can stave off tumor progression and trigger cell death in other cancer cell lines, including breast carcinoma, prostate carcinoma, colorectal carcinoma, skin carcinoma, and pancreatic adenocarcinoma. Next up today, from Juneau, Alaska, Alaska judge rejects pot recriminalization measure. An Alaska Superior Court judge this week struck down provisions of a new state law seeking to criminalize the possession of small amounts of cannabis in the privacy of one's home. The law, enacted in June, redefined minor marijuana possession as a criminal offense, punishable by jail time, and defined the possession of more than 4 ounces of cannabis as a felony offense. The Alaska ACLU filed suit last month to block enforcement of the law, arguing that it violates the privacy clause of the state constitution, which provides that, quote, the right of the people to privacy is recognized and shall not be infringed, close quote. In a 1975 Alaska State Supreme Court ruling, Raven versus the state, justices determined that this constitutional provision encompassed the possession and use of small amounts of cannabis within the home. Superior Court Judge Patricia Collins ruled Monday that the Alaska legislature lacks the authority to override the Supreme Court's 1975 decision. Quote, the Alaska Supreme Court has repeatedly and consistently characterized the Raven decision as announcing a constitutional limitation on the government's authority to enact legislation prohibiting the possession of marijuana in the privacy of one's home, close quote, she determined. The judge continued, quote, that decision is the law until and unless the Supreme Court takes contrary action, close quote. Collins' ruling strikes down sections of the new law criminalizing the possession of 1 ounce or less of cannabis, but leaves in place measures prohibiting the possession of greater amounts. Under the 2006 law, possession of 1 to 4 ounces of marijuana is a misdemeanor punishable by up to a year in jail. Quote, the Alaska Court of Appeals has held that the legislature has the power to set reasonable limits on the amount of marijuana that people can possess for personal use in their homes, and that such regulation does not conflict with Raven, close quote, Collins determined. Lawyers for the Alaska Attorney General's office are expected to appeal Collins' ruling. In 2004, the Alaska Supreme Court rejected a petition by the Attorney General's office to reconsider a September 2003 Court of Appeals decision that the possession of marijuana by adults within the home is constitutionally protected activity. Governor Frank Murkowski, who strongly advocated for the new law, has argued that Raven should no longer apply in Alaska because cannabis may pose greater health and safety risks today than it did in 1975. This has been Normal News from the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. More information about the stories today and membership in the foundation is available at norml.org. You can catch our new daily podcast, Normal's Daily Audio Stash, at normalaudiostash.com. I'm Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.